Penguin presents War by Roald Dahl. Read for you by Dan Stevens, Killian Murphy, Sophie Okonedo, Julian Rindtut, and Stephen Mangan.
Going Solo by Roald Dahl. Read by Dan Stevens. A life is made up of a great number of small incidents, and a small number of great ones. An autobiography must therefore, unless it is to become tedious, be extremely selective, discarding all the inconsequential incidents in one's life, and concentrating upon those that have remained vivid in the memory. The first part of this book takes up my own personal story precisely where my earlier autobiography, which was called Boy, left off. I am away to East Africa on my first job. But because any job, even if it is in Africa, is not continuously enthralling, I have tried to be as selective as possible and have written only about those moments that I consider memorable. In the second part of the book, which deals with the time I went flying with the RAF in the Second World War, there was no need to select or discard because every moment was, to me at any rate, totally enthralling. The Voyage Out. The ship that was carrying me away from England to Africa in the autumn of 1938 was called the SS Mantola. She was an old paint-peeling tub of 9,000 tons with a single tall funnel and a vibrating engine that rattled the teacups in their saucers on the dining room table. The voyage from the port of London to Mombasa would take 2 weeks, and on the way we were going to call in Marseille, Malta, Port Said, Suez, Port Sudan and Aden. Nowadays you can fly to Mombasa in a few hours, and you stop nowhere and nothing is fabulous anymore. But in 1938, a journey like that was full of stepping stones, and East Africa was a long way from home, especially if your contract with the Shell Company said that you were to stay out there for 3 years at a stretch. I was 22 when I left. I would be 25 before I saw my family again. What I still remember so clearly about that voyage is the extraordinary behaviour of my fellow passengers. I had never before encountered that peculiar, empire-building breed of Englishman who spends his whole life working in distant corners of British territory. Please do not forget that in the 1930s, the British Empire was still very much the British Empire, and the men and women who kept it going were a race of people that most of you have never encountered, and now you never will. I consider myself very lucky to have caught a glimpse of this rare species while it still roamed the forests and foothills of the earth, for today it is totally extinct. More English than the English, more Scottish than the Scots, they were the craziest bunch of humans I shall ever meet. For one thing, they spoke a language of their own. If they worked in East Africa, their sentences were sprinkled with Swahili words, and if they lived in India, then all manner of dialects were intermingled. As well as this, there was a whole vocabulary of much-used words that seemed to be universal among all these people. An evening drink, for example, was always a sundowner. A drink at any other time was a chota peg. One's wife was the Mem Sahib. To have a look at something was to have a shufti. And from that one, interestingly enough, RAF, Middle Eastern slang, for a reconnaissance plane in the last war was a shufti kite. Something of poor quality was shenzi, supper was tiffin, and so on and so forth. The empire builder's jargon would have filled a dictionary. All in all, it was rather wonderful for me, a conventional young lad from the suburbs, to be thrust suddenly into the middle of this pack of sinewy, sunburnt gophers and their bright, bony little wives. And what I liked best of all about them was their eccentricities. It would seem that when the British live for years in a foul and sweaty climate among foreign people, they maintain their sanity by allowing themselves to go slightly dotty. They cultivate bizarre habits that would never be tolerated back home, whereas in faraway Africa, or in Ceylon, or in India, or in the Federated Malay States, they could do as they liked. On the SS Mantola, just about everybody had his or her own particular maggot in the brain, and for me it was like watching a kind of non-stop pantomime throughout the entire voyage. Let me tell you about two or three of these comedians. I was sharing my cabin with the manager of a cotton mill in the Punjab called U.N. Savory. I could hardly believe those initials when I first saw them on his trunk. And I had the upper berth. From my pillow I could therefore look out on the porthole clear across the lifeboat deck and over the wide blue ocean beyond. On our fourth morning at sea, I happened to wake up very early,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?